Big Ideas presents Shel Israel, author of Twitterville, How Businesses Can Thrive in the New Global Neighborhoods. The lecture was recorded at the Berkeley Church in Toronto on September 15, 2009. Big Ideas is a TVO production. For more information, visit tvo.org.
Since 2005, I've essentially been talking to people about social media. I've talked now to over 400 people. They're in 38 countries. They're a very diverse group. I've talked to the vice chairman of General Motors, the founder chairman of Dell Computer, Ethan Bodner, who was a high school student at the time. He's gone on to do well. He became an Eagle Scout and then went to Yale, but he's happier about the Eagle Scout part. I interviewed Wael Abbas, who does a neat little thing in Egypt. He gets citizen-generated videos of police torturing citizens, and he uploads them onto YouTube. I don't know how long that career will last, and his monetization model is worse than my own. During this whole time, it has amazed me in two ways. One is the enormous diversity of social media, the different ways it's used, the way the tools work together, the original content that's produced. The other thing that's amazed me is I've started to have the really wonderful pleasure of talking to people all over the world is how much alike we all are. And that's something that maybe I felt early in life and tended to forget, but when I was coming around to Twitterville, I started realizing the amount of factual evidence that I've seen of people everywhere expressing the same thoughts, the same dreams, the same ways they want to live. That brings me to global neighborhoods, which always chokes me up. It's a simple concept, and that is that because of social media, we can reorganize ourselves into places where people share things in common rather than geographic ground. So that if you're interested in hummingbirds or hummers or social media or football or soccer or whatever, you will find people who share your interests who you never possibly could have met, you probably never would have heard about, and you can have simple, unedited, unfiltered conversations with them. You meet them in a place that isn't real. You can't see people's smiles. You can't look in their eyes. But somehow or other, the relationships that form there are real. Sometimes they lead to business. Sometimes they lead to inspiration. Sometimes they lead to pushing the block button on Twitter. It's your choice. But it is restructuring every institution that there is. And I could go on to one of my long and ranting sidebars about how it's doing that, but I think most of you in this room already know it. Why do I call it Twitterville? I stuck this slide in because I got asked this question a lot of times, and I thought it was obvious, but I guess it isn't. To me, the magic of Twitter is that for each of us, we live in a small town. Twitter itself is larger than the world's largest cities. It's growing faster than the world's largest megalopolises. But it's still like that backyard fence that Joe made reference to. It's like a coffee house. You have conversations, you meet people you know. When you meet someone new, you can easily find out from neighbors of yours about that person and why you should like them or not like them or follow them or believe them or whatever. We live in Twitterville, almost the way we did in an earlier phase in North America when we were small town people, and we had our influence because of our reputations. And our reputations came by what we did and said rather than what our brand was and how many exposures we could have in a media campaign. Twitter is one of 14 books that I know of on the subject. I just heard number 15. I was just thrilled to hear that. Worse than that, I've looked at a lot of these books, and I'm here to tell you they're all pretty good. And that really sucks if you're the 14th guy on the block. What's different about my book is it doesn't try to tell you how to use it. It doesn't even try to tell you why to use it. What it really does, or what I really did, is I asked a whole bunch of people how they were using Twitter, and I tried to get their stories. Ferg Devins is here. He's one of the people I met on Twitter when I said, hey, I'm looking for B2C stories. Anybody got one? Ferg, I suspect, took a sip and tweeted me. As a matter of fact, 75% of the stories, and there's more than 100 stories that I tell in that book, came to me by just going to Twitter and saying, hey, I'm looking for. I got over 300 suggestions. I seriously considered 150 of them, and I'm not sure of the final number. It's somewhere between 90 and 110. And the book is these people telling me and you how they use Twitter in business, in government, in nonprofit, in a variety of ways, in home offices, in global enterprises. Each of the stories is unique from all the others one way or another, and each of the stories have certain commonality to them. Most of what I'm going to do now is just tell you about them. James Buck is why I wrote Twitterville. I didn't know it, he didn't know it, we didn't meet. He's one of three people that I asked for an interview for, and he didn't want to do it, he was too busy. James Buck, in April of 2008, was a graduate student in journalism at UC Berkeley, not the Berkeley out here, the one in California. And he decided to do a graduate project by going to Egypt and doing a photojournalistic report on the food strikes. A week before he went, he was having a going away party with a few friends, and one of them said, hey, Egypt plays rough. We want you to take this program, it's called Twitter, and it fits onto a mobile app, you need to get Twitterberry, take it, go there, and if you get in any trouble, let us know. And he said, yeah, sure, whatever. But he did it, which turned out to be a good thing because he got into trouble. He stayed a good distance away from riots as they broke out, fires broke out, police were clubbing people, people were fighting back with the police. But he suddenly found himself, despite the fact he used a telephoto lens, was doing everything he could to stay out of trouble, getting hauled into a police car. He was being taken away to a jail. I suspect it might be one of the ones Wael Abbas had done smuggled videos into YouTube with. And he smiled at the officer next to him, took out his BlackBerry, smiled again, and typed in a single word, arrested. That word hurtled through the miracle of modern technology to Berkeley, California, where some of his 94 friends immediately saw it and started writing tweets to other people, who then wrote to other people, who then wrote to other people. Probably on the fifth or sixth circle out of that rock that went into the pond, I saw the word arrested. I started investigating. I started finding out what was going on. I started getting the story in little spoonfuls, as did some of the media just about the same time. As did, much to my astonishment, the United States State Department, which acted with uncharacteristic haste in acting. And 24 hours later, James was popped out of jail, put into the same car that he had been brought to jail in, pulled out the same BlackBerry and typed a second one-word tweet, freed. James and Adam Clyde are very different. He's a Marcom for headquarters of IBM in Armonk, New York. He also reached me through Twitter, and his company and his operation story were a little different in some ways, but it's still just about talking with each other. IBM doesn't care if any of you ever look at any of the tweets. And there are thousands of tweets from now about 1,200 tweeters. I need to update the slide. They talk to each other. They talk to their ecosystem. They're all B2B. They don't care about consumers directly in one way or another. They share information. In fact, it's a real-time 24/7 newsletter. This is how you find out about IBM if you're a customer, a partner, if you're thinking of going to work there and you're smart, if you're an editor covering the stories of IBM. This is the best source. And the irony, of course, is IBM once bought a company called Lotus for Lotus Notes, which was supposed to do the same thing behind a firewall, and I guess IBM found that Twitter was cooler and faster. David Alston works for Radiant 6, and actually I found the story because Radiant 6 also pitched their way to the book, and I turned them down. I think they have a great tool. They're friends of mine, but they didn't have a story that I thought was applicable to everyone else. So after Marcel, I'm forgetting his last name, after the founder CEO gave up on that, he sent me yet another tweet saying, hey, you should speak to David. He's got a pretty good tale. And David's story is about moving in Brunswick, where they're located, after 8 years. They were going to do the move themselves, they being he and his wife, Mary Gwen. And Mary Gwen was taking care of the issue, and she was treated extremely rudely by a U-Haul clerk. So David tweeted, my wife was just treated rudely by U-Haul, and I guess they don't want our business. No, do they want our business? And he later would tell me he really was hoping U-Haul would come on and say, oh my God, I'm sorry this happened, forgive us, we'll make good, what can we do? But U-Haul wasn't on social media. As a matter of fact, we would later find out they weren't really on the internet very much. But what David also found out, in the virtue of the fact that within 10 minutes he received more than 10 tweets, is a lot of people had a lot of horror stories about U-Haul. And the stories were a lot worse than his. Some involved renting trucks in Arizona where the road temperature is sometimes over 110 degrees, and noticing that the tires had no tread on them. And when they went over the pavement with a heavy load, that was life-threatening. Many of these stories went on. Other bloggers picked it up. In David's case, the Ogilvy blog, I forgot the name of the person who does that, but it's very, very well known. And it's followed by marketing people, advertising people, PR people. And she did an analysis, she being the author of the blog, that showed how in a short period of time, 28 or 30,000 people had been made aware of customers who hated U-Haul. And no one had stepped forward and said, wait a minute, I had a good experience with U-Haul. If your name were Penske, this would be a very good time for you. If your name is U-Haul, you're in trouble. The story goes on. It gets picked up by CNN. It makes major media. I believe the New York Times covered it at one point. The CEO of U-Haul gets on a talk show, a heavily followed one, and when he's hit with all this stuff, he says, yeah, my company makes a lot of mistakes, but you know the buck stops here. My cell phone number is, and they put the cell phone number at the bottom of the screen, and if you have a problem with U-Haul, you call me and I'll make good. David didn't watch the show, but he did get about 653 zillion direct mail saying, hey, David, here's a phone number for you. And David texted, and no, he called, and he got a voicemail, and he said, I'm very, very sorry that I didn't reach you. I've had a bad experience, and I would like you to make good. And the CEO called him back and left a voicemail saying, I'm sorry I missed you. Can you text me the details? And David texted him the details. And I'll call you back tomorrow. Well, there's a line in a movie, tomorrow never comes. That's what happened for David with U-Haul. The CEO sounded good. He was really good on television. But David had the phone number, which he shared with me, which you'll find in the book. So if you have a bad problem with him, you can call. There's been a generation called the broadcast era. It began in the 50s and it is now coming to an end. And that's when U-Haul could do advertising that showed happy families happily chugging along in trailers, and those who didn't have that experience couldn't tell anyone but a few friends. That's gone, and we're entering into a conversational era. Instead of shouting in our TV sets, we can now tweet. And I think there's a great deal of power in that. Witness number 7 is J.R. Cohen. J.R. Cohen is a manager of the Coffee Grounds. It's a coffee shop in Midtown Houston, Texas. Business was okay. It's not just coffee. They have lunches. They have a wine and beer session, wine and beer license, and they have dinners there. And things are pretty good in the morning until this company opened up a few blocks away. You've seen them in this area too. They're called Starbucks. And Starbucks tweets, except Starbucks has one person. His name is Brad Nelson. He's also a really nice guy. He's in the book too. But he is at Starbucks. And that is something that is approved by PR at Starbucks. You can't be at Starbucks in Midtown Houston. And if you were at Starbucks Midtown Houston, there happened to be seven of them, so it would be hard to figure out which one you were talking to or which real human you were talking to. Not so the coffee grounds. Everyone knows it's J.R. Cohen. He's there from 5 in the morning till about 11 o'clock every night, six nights a week. He works 6 hours on Sundays, I believe. So he started looking at Starbucks and figuring out how he could fight back. Starbucks was doing well with online people because they had Wi-Fi, so JR came out with free Wi-Fi. He noticed while he was hanging out there, he was becoming a regular customer at Starbucks, that everybody was always fumbling around on the floor looking for a power outlet. So he decided to put two power outlets by every table, and this helped, and he started getting people trickling along. And then he started using different kinds of social media, and just like everybody else when he got to Twitter, he was pretty clueless for a while. But just like everybody else who sticks it out for more than 30 days, things started happening. In his case, there was a customer of his. This is another beer reference, but it's not a brand, I have to tell you now. The tweeter's name is at Maslow's Beer. I don't know why Maslow was called that, but he sent a message to at Coffee Ground saying, "Late to work, starving. Can you fix me a burrito? And I'll pick it up in the parking lot." And I always have this image of JR going like this, but I don't know that that happened. But JR tweeted back in about 30 seconds saying, "What kind of sauce do you want on it?" But what happened was, that was a public tweet, and other people in Houston said, "Wow, that's so cool. Can I tweet orders?" And immediately it had to go DM, or else people, you know, Starbucks would be sitting down there ordering all kinds of stuff and never showing up. But he created the first DM breakfast drive-by restaurant service. Others actually have picked up and are doing this. There's one in San Francisco that's doing this. But that's the beginning of what happened. And that was a nice little bump for business, but that wasn't really going to make the year for them. But what happened is the Twitter people started hanging out there, and they started tweeting about the free Wi-Fi, and that helped business a little more. And then one day somebody came in and said, "You know, we got a lot of people who tweet. We do this really weird thing. It's like a cult. It's like the Odd Fellows used to be. We call them tweet-ups. Would you mind if we brought in a couple of hundred people on next Thursday night?" JR took less time than he did to say, "What kind of sauce do you want?" And he said, "Of course." 225 people showed up for the first. 125 about them had never been in his coffee shop before. Now, this is big business. If you're a restaurant, you got 225 more people in your restaurant. This is good stuff. The really good stuff was those 125. Maybe 30 of them decided to become customers, started bringing in friends, started tweeting about it. So to make this very long story short, these events started making other people say, "Hey, this is a great place to have events." And so more events started happening. And as a result of Maslow's Beer's Burrito, business in year over year increased by, I'm not allowed to give the number, but a healthy double-digit number. All because Maslow was hungry. This is not a coffee shop story. One day I went to Twitterville and I said, "Hey everybody, I'm looking for really unique business stories." And Bill Ferris in Detroit, Michigan said, "Well, we're going to do a robotic surgery and we're going to live tweet it to a convention in Las Vegas." And I said, "That's passingly interesting." "Is this plastic surgery? What's going on?" Live surgery does Vegas. It didn't sound right. And as the story unfolded, it was a very serious surgery. It wasn't cosmetic. It was a very delicate prostate cancer removal. So delicate, a human hand couldn't use it. A robot had to do it. The surgeon in charge neither tweeted nor did he touch the patient. A robot did this, and he operated a keyboard that told the robot what to do. 600 people at the Bellagio Hotel who were already in the medical profession, who were trying to get educated about robotics, got a play-by-play as it went on. At that time, there was no video component. It's hard to see in this picture, but the surgery is actually going on 26 feet from where those two people are tweeting. They're not the communications department. One's an anesthesiologist, and the other one is a surgeon himself. And they were taking Q&A, and they were doing it for education. And it was very impressive, and that was it. It was a one-fer thing they forgot. A few weeks later, I got a contact from CNN saying, "Where did you get that robot surgeon thing from?" CNN needed a little education too, but they picked up the story and that played a little bit, and then things started happening. Other hospitals said, "Hey, we ought to do a robotic surgery tweeting too." And suddenly, Twitter and social media is starting to be used to share information and for education in medicine and hopefully in science. The next time I see you, I hope this expands beyond it. Several things have happened at Henry Ford. Henry Ford was historically considered a top of second tier hospital. Not bad, but it's Detroit. You don't want to go to Detroit, do you? Well, what happened was people started wanting to go to Detroit for this surgery because this kind of surgery is elective and there's just a few hospitals in the country that can do it. And most people that undergo it have to travel. I don't think they go to Vegas for this stuff. So they started picking up a little business. Then the second thing happened is they started picking up a little reputation because they were picking up business, and now you have doctors who are saying, "I won't mind going to Detroit. We get paid the same in New York City as we do in Detroit. We do a lot better by making that money in Detroit." So they started getting better and more surgeons applying. They started getting graduates from the best medical schools applying to work at Henry Ford, all because this guy said, "I've got an idea for a good story." So I'm proud of that one. Stacy Monk was a tech project manager. If you had a big launch, she was arms and legs. You brought her in to consult. She made good money at it. She didn't like it very much. Her heart was and is in nonprofit and volunteer work. She took some time off in 2008 for what was supposed to be a long, slow trip from South Africa to Egypt. And she intentionally used the slowest transportation she could find. I won't go into details, but if you've seen an Indiana Jones movie, you've got some idea of some of the things she's done. They included sitting on top of a steam train, which doesn't sound like fun to me. When she got to Tanzania, she met the woman who you can barely see in the front. Her name is Mama Lucy Campton. And Mama Lucy's profession is she's a chicken farmer. But she was concerned about the schools in Tanzania because the education was bad. She could do a little about that. But more than that, the kids were getting no nutrition. And she could do a lot about that. She also had cows, so she could provide milk and chicken and other foods. And she got a few other farmers to join in. And so she had a school going in a vacated lot by a large piece of property that she lived adjacent to. And everything went well. When Stacy got there, she worked at the school for a month. Mama Lucy and Stacy really bonded. They stayed in touch. She came home. She was living in Florida trying to figure out how to start a cause-based business, a nonprofit business called Epic Change. One day she got email from Mama Lucy. That isn't easy. Mama Lucy has to go to town. She has to wait in a computer cafe and so on. But it said that a bad thing had happened. The schoolhouse was being taken back by the landlord. It was going to be torn down because the landlord had just rented the property next to Mama Lucy to an industrial chicken producer. Mama Lucy didn't care about that part. She cared about the kids, and she asked Stacy if she could help. No one in social media knew Stacy at that time, but she did know one guy. His name was Sam Lawrence. He does Go Big Always. And Sam said, "Hey, write a guest blog. I've got eyeballs. Use them." She did. She told the story. People said how much they cared. Some guy whose name I forget in D.C. said, hey, Thanksgiving's coming up. Maybe you can leverage something. And so they came up in a very short period of time with something called Tweetsgiving. In November of 08, I think the 14th through the 19th, just before the American Thanksgiving, she put it up and she put a little chip-in meter up so you could see, and she asked people to give money. She raised $16,800 in 5 days. The average donation was $10.46. A lot of people gave a little bit of money. And that has become the formula for raising money on Twitterville. A woman named Beth Cantor, who is probably the best known social media fundraiser, created a little formula. You make it personal. You talk about Mama Lucy. You show pictures of the kids. You make it urgent. You make it a very short timeline. You make sure at least 98% of the money is actually going to the cause you're talking about. And then you start tweeting like crazy. So Tweetsgiving was pretty good. And then Stacy followed Beth's advice again, and she kept following up. And one of the follow-up photos, which I'm not going to show you right now, is a wall of Adobe, of which thousands of Twitter handles were written in by the school children that go to the new school they built with the $16,800. This is the last story I'm going to tell you. It may be the first story in my next book. It's probably my favorite story. If you could see it, this is a picture of United U.S. Air Flight 1549 landing last December on the Hudson River. Janis Krums, born in Latvia, moved to Sarasota, Florida, wanted to go to a conference on sports enhancement drinks in Manhattan. He was young. He was eager to get into business. He didn't have a lot of money. He drove his car up, parked it in New Jersey, stayed in a cheap motel in New Jersey, took the ferry over to Manhattan, attended his conference, and a funny thing happened on the way back. The plane landed about two football fields away from where his ferry was. And he whipped out an iPhone, and he tweeted in, plane just landed on the Hudson near me. Incredible. And he used a brand new product. It hadn't been out a month yet. It was called TwitPix. Now there are many others that do this. But it really integrates photos into Twitterville, and this was about the first time anybody understood its power. What happened next was astounding. Giannis's last words were, "I'm going to go help." Somebody said, "Hey, can I borrow your phone?" He handed the phone over. He got into a lifeboat, and he actually was one of three people who went inside the sinking airplane and rescued a flight attendant who had broken two legs and could not get off. Got her into a lifeboat, got her into a deck chair on the ferry. Somebody handed the phone back to him. It was ringing. He picked it up and heard, "Hi, this is Bill Sullivan, and you're live on NBC. And while Giannis was sitting there saying, "How the hell did this guy get my phone number?" viewers everywhere were seeing this photo and hearing Giannis's voice 27 minutes after the first tweet. The really incredible thing with this story is at this point, the press, who for a very long time has dealt with the social media community with disdain, with contempt, with anger, sometimes with belated integration. "Hi, we're the New York Times and we blog, read us and be quiet." But at this point, the news media was understanding that they're going to have to go through some significant changes. They'd gone through 10 years of budget cuts. The reason why I had to blog, I couldn't get a job in it. And they had had worldwide networks of stringers, of correspondents, of this person and that person who would get the news from any part of the world and give it to them, and they couldn't afford those people. They were all gone. And they turned around and discovered, my God, there are networks of feed on the street. We became the feed on the street. And the media finally understood that there is a huge opportunity for them to use their discipline, their credibility, their processes, and integrate it with the delivery of news. So braided journalism, which is a term I love, which is a term I'm seriously considering writing my next book about, is the concept of traditional journalism and citizen journalism braiding in social media spaces. And if the more I think about it, the larger I see the opportunity for the world to get news in a healthier and better organized way than we have. That's my story. I'm sticking with it, and I'll take any questions you have.
One of the things that I'm wondering is, what do I, as a professor and my colleagues, what do we need to teach the next generation about Twitter?
I've been talking to professors and people, including students, at some of the best American journalistic schools, and have really been saddened in a lot of ways. I feel that in the terms of journalism, students are being taught to take jobs that no longer exist, and they all have this multimedia executive elective, and that's supposed to do it. I think what is going to happen in the universities as a short period of time goes by and people like me are forced to shut up and sit down and a new generation comes in and starts taking our place in the marketplace, in the classroom and everywhere else, they're bringing social media with you. My greatest horror story in education is my granddaughter, who lives in Portland, Oregon, and was told she couldn't use Google to research a paper on Lewis and Clark because that was cheating. She could go to the library and use the Dewey Decimal System like the good Lord intended. Can I say good Lord in a former church? Is that okay? And there is this mismatch between universities and change. It's not new. It's happened many times before. And that, in my generation, led to a great deal of alienation when my generation started learning that all the history we had learned up till then wasn't exactly the way it had happened. We became angry. So I think universities and higher education really need to race to catch up to the students who are going to be coming in there, who are going to be comfortable with the social media tools, are going to be comfortable in doing their research while you're giving your lecture. If I were to do a blog on that, which I just decided I'm going to do, I think I would call it the Real-Time University. One thing I'd add, there's one other thing that just happened that I think is awesome. I come from the most impoverished state in my nation, California. We owe more money than we used to make. Yet we just announced for the first time that they're going to introduce, and the details aren't clear yet, e-books into education. And they're going to do that because it is absolutely impossible to keep current in science and history. It's also going to be done so that students who cannot afford textbooks can now have something other than last year's used throwaways. And I think this is one of those little seeds that's going to grow a very big beanstalk, and I'm pretty excited about it.
My question to you is that it's obvious that Twitter has really taken off with industry and professionals, but why do you think, I mean, there's been a lot of talk recently, especially why, or, you know, the problem that there's a lot of youth that's not on Twitter. You know, what is your take on that? And do you think that would be changing anytime soon?
Two very good questions. Where things start really shape the culture of the starting point. Facebook began in elite university fraternities, and it was all about rating pretty girls. And while it has evolved from there, and incidentally, I might add, it took off in Canada before the United States. While it's evolved from there, it's always maintained that young, kind of testy culture, and then put on top of that layers of direct marketing, advertising, and other things that I don't find particularly appealing. Twitter began as a professional mobile app. It began to solve a problem for a 12-member team called Odeo. Their dream was to achieve something they never did. But while they were trying to achieve the first dream, they had a problem. They were a Web 2.0 company. They were mostly developers. If you know anything about Web 2.0 developers, they work wherever the hell they feel like it, whenever they want. And so when you needed to meet with them, it was hard to find them. And if you did find them, it was even harder to figure out if the meeting you wanted to take them away from the work to attend was more important than what they were doing before you pulled them away. So at that time, there were only two founders, and that was Biz Stone and Ev Williams. And they said, they found themselves always asking, what are you doing right now? What are you doing? And they'd go crazy because they couldn't have their meeting. So they had an off-campus, and it came up. And the guy that became Jack Dorsey, who became the third partner, when Biz Stone said the problem, says, I think I can help. And Jack's quick profile is he came out of St. Louis, where he fell in love with the technology behind dispatch. Don't ask me why. I have no idea why. But he couldn't believe that people could know which fire engine to send where, which police car could go where, and whatever. And he started working with it. He started playing with it. He had ideas. He started an internet taxi dispatch company, short-lived. And, oh, yeah, he picked 2001, which I've already mentioned wasn't a great year. After that, wherever he went as a consultant, he kept trying to sell this idea. Whenever he had an employer, which wasn't that often until Twitter came along, he had this idea, and they all said, yeah, later. And then at that moment, he said, I have an idea. Biz said, oh, yeah, what? 2 weeks later, TWTTR, it didn't yet grow vowels, was born. It isn't a whole lot different than what you see now, which causes some of the problem. But they began by telling their friends they had something cool, which is, you know, marketing agencies say, we do viral marketing. This is viral marketing. You can't do it. It happens. And they told their friends, who are young Web 2.0 professionals, who told their friends, so at the core of Twitter, a young, not that young, maybe 30, 35 is the average age, professionals who work with all sorts of people, and that's how Twitter has grown out. It no longer skews to any age demographic, but it certainly skews to an older demographic than Facebook. I think it will continue to, and its culture is always being tested. You know, Britney Spears is not a business application. You know, and there are lots of challenges to it, but at the core of the culture are young mobile professionals who are very, very much at home with doing the things that Eden's doing right here, allowing me to have a face-to-forehead conversation with her as she tells all those people out there that Shell really sucks tonight.
It's Steve Williams from St. Michael's Hospital. When I talk about Twitter with senior executives or senior leadership in the organizations I'm involved with, they all kind of hem and haw and say it's just a fad. So what's your, I know you're, you sort of answered this in the previous question, but what's your best argument that it's not simply just a fad?
A hospital is like any other business. You have to go where your customers are going and guess where they're going. That's the short answer. Culturally, hospitals have a system. Lives depend on that system. They are worried about regulation. They're worried about money. They're worried about finding competent staff. They're worried about changes in our healthcare system in the U.S. Your system isn't in that flux right now. And into this comes something new. Not only is it new, it's not this little add-on. You don't just go do that social media thing in the corner. It kind of starts in the corner and comes up and takes over. And they don't like it. And I don't blame them for not liking it. If they really want to understand what's about to happen to their institution, they shouldn't listen to me or even you. They should go down the hall and talk to their kids. And if they don't have kids, they should go speak to somebody else's kids, particularly the pediatricians, which amazingly are flooding into Twitterville these days. But you are up against solving a problem that every company has, and in medical, in any healthcare area, in government, is going to move more slowly than it's going to move among a bunch of wired-haired propeller heads in Silicon Valley. but it's going to happen, as sure the night of the day, and if they don't do it, another hospital will do it. On Sunday night, a guy named Tom Stitt, who's a good friend of mine, has this Twitter meetup, healthcare social, it's either HCSM or SMHC, I'm not sure which. It's California time, it starts at 6 p.m., and there are thousands of healthcare professionals talking, sharing information and ideas, complaining about the people they work with hating social media. I advise you to join it and talk to those people.
Twitter is now a global infrastructure that people depend on for communication. Maybe, what are your thoughts on the fact that it's a private company that's hemorrhaging money despite all of the VC, and the fact that the State Department has to ask them to not go down for maintenance because of what's going on in Iran? What are the implications of that, especially for people that are interested in doing business via this medium?
The story starts with the prior question. Twitter didn't begin with a business plan. It began with solving a little problem, some cool stuff, and the end of one day there were 25 people using it, and it was designed for a 12-person company. More than that, it was an open source company, so it never dawned on the founders to say, hey, that's ours, don't share it. So it began without any thought of monetization, and since then it has been scrambling. The money behind Twitter is brilliant money. It's Jeff Bezos, who founded Amazon.com, and everybody thought he was kind of crazy to leave Wall Street to do books, turned out to be okay. Jack Wilson's one of the legendary guys who always, always picks companies that nobody wants. One of them was Google. Google, you remember them, they did search. Search was worthless. You couldn't monetize it. The founder of Yahoo, who owned search, would be happy to give it away. As a matter of fact, when Google was Twitter's age, everybody was saying, here's a company, they're bleeding money, they're not making a dime, and they don't have a clue how they're going to make money. The Twitter guys really have a clue. There was a story that was done when the DDoS attack happened, and that one shocked me. I would have thought those guys knew enough not to be in one network. I worked in a 20-person company that knew well enough not to do that. But they were so busy trying to scale that they didn't get to those details. When they have those details, and when this is rock solid reliable, they will start monetizing. They won't do it on the user side. It's unlikely but possible that they will inject advertising. But they are going to start offering utilities as offering the service. Now let's look at what they did and how it plays out. Let's take Comcast. Most of you know the Comcast story, right? No? Okay, very quickly. Comcast is America's leading cable carrier. We like them less than I think you like your cable carrier. And year after year after year, it was in the bottom 10 of every customer satisfaction survey. The only thing that was good is it couldn't go any lower in customer satisfaction, so they didn't keep going down anymore. The only thing that was noteworthy before Twitter about Comcast was that one time a Comcast repair person showed up to fix somebody's TV, and the person who let the Comcast repair person left the room, came back and found the repair guy on the couch, sound asleep, snoring. Unlike days of yore, she could retaliate. She picked up a handy cam, she went over, she tiptoed in, she got close enough to pick up the sound of him snoring. And she posted on YouTube, where by now over 2 million people have seen it. Frank Eliason is a Comcast service guy who actually does care about customers. He got permission to go onto Twitter, where he started Comcast Cares, and now he does it in public. Instead of a call center where some people succeed and some people fail, you can actually see him and now 10 other people showing the world that they care. If you're the person who's on the phone, you can now hang up while he goes and works on the diagnostics, and then he'll tweet you when he's ready to tell you something. In the old days, you had to sit on the phone hearing, your call is important to us, please stay on the line. And so Let's look at the value to Comcast, who this year increased 9.4 points in surveys of customer satisfaction, with the only change being the work they were doing on Twitter. If 2 years ago, when Comcast started, Twitter said, "What will you pay for us to allow you to provide service on what we're offering?" The answer would have been $5, $6 a month, something like that. Now, after all this measurable business case analysis, it's a case study in Harvard Business now. The New York Times has written about it about 92 times. Every other company is seeing what Comcast has done, and now all that Twitter needs to do is know they're not going to go down unexpectedly as they continue to do. When that happens, the value of providing service there for big companies is going to be a lot more than $5 a month.
Last year in 2008, Buelo started out of South by Southwest in Texas, a Twitter-like site where me as a PHP developer could give you help on your problems and you would give me expertise points in return. In Toronto, we have Sprouter, which is a Twitter for entrepreneurs. And I wanted to ask you, what do you think when you see businesses, new businesses, adopt a very Twitter-like model for their companies?
The only reason I'd be sad to see Twitter not be the universally accepted platform is I'm selling a book that promotes the company. I'm interested in what people do on social media. Sooner or later, Twitter will be replaced. I don't know with what. I hope I'm around to be surprised. Maybe our avatars start talking and those that use goofy things are really going to be in trouble. So if you come up with something that's cooler than Twitter and is good enough and strong enough to disrupt the Twitter base and find new customers of your own, I'm all for you. I'm all for the customer and the tech companies. You know, when they go out of business, they're valuable commodities to the people that put them out of business.
Okay, I've got several clients that are involved in pretty complex things, technologically speaking. And what they're asking me is, and, you know, they're asking me about Twitter and how they can apply that, because their belief or their thought, structure is that they'd have to kind of dummy down to pack what they would have to say to their clients in 140 characters, because they're also afraid of competitive faux pas, you know? So what suggestions can you offer me and, I guess, them in terms of...
I could write a book of suggestions, but I'll try to be briefer. Okay. First of all, the idea of offering anything in 140 characters is the wrong perception. That's one spoonful of a very big bowl of nutritious soup. And the beauty of Twitter is its interactivity and its conversation. Point one is nobody should say on social media anything that will bring any company security at risk, embarrass the company in any way. And just about every employee in the world, when they get hired, get instructed and often have to sign saying exactly that. I'm not going to do anything boneheaded that hurts my company. Any company in the world needs to have conversations with customers that are private, and they need to have conversations that are public. But you're still focusing on only half the equation, because most companies that come to Twitter come to tell something and they find out there's greater value in listening. New tweeters count their followers and veteran tweeters pay attention to who they follow because that's their source of information. It could be that the type of problem and the type of company, which you didn't share with me, that you're talking about isn't suited for this particular social media tool. They should begin by listening. They should look around and see what's there that's valuable. And if they can't find what's valuable, maybe it's not the right tool for them.